Chapter 11. Counterfeit Culture. Amin stretched across the leather sofa in his office. He napped, while next to him an associate of his, a fellow industrialist, smoked a cigarette in the dark. Seeing me come in, the friend kicked the bottom of Amin's shoe, and he snapped awake. "Sit," he said, while turning on a light. On a small table next to the sofa was a kettle. Amin reached for it and turned on the switch. All sorts of people came through this office, suppliers, customers, family and friends, and they often drank tea here. In this part of the country, factory owners were partial to a particular kind of tea set that was made of plain white porcelain, and the cups were smaller than I had seen elsewhere. They were barely large enough for a quick small sip. He brought out the canister of tea and dug into it with a wooden scoop. "Tie guanyin," he said, indicating the type of tea. Taking the leaves out, he filled a small bowl that had a curved lip. He then poured in hot water and placed a small lid on top, careful to position the lid at just such an angle so that when it was tilted over the cups, the tea trickled out, while the leaves remained held back. Pouring tea in this fashion was a tricky business. The bowl itself was thin, and the water scalding hot, and only the edges of the bowl could be handled. It was something of a balancing act, meant to be done with only one hand. Amin picked up the bowl, gripping it and the lid together, and then he poured, alternating back and forth over the small cups in a seemingly random fashion until they were all filled to the brim. We were each given a small cup of tea to drink. Amin slurped his tea in one go, deliberately leaving a few drops behind in the cup. He tilted his cup to show me that it contained the dregs that were too fine to be filtered by the bowl's lid. After tossing these into the tea tray with a flick of his wrist, he showed me the cup again so that I could see that it had been properly cleaned. Just like any social ritual, there were subtleties. How someone poured tea or handled a cup might hint at background, status, or personality type. Amin slid the tea tray over in my direction so that I might have a turn pouring. I had been in his office enough to know that not everyone got this chance. The leaves that were already in the bowl could be used again, so all I had to do was replenish the hot water and pour. After picking up the small bowl and holding it by the edges with my thumb and ring finger, I positioned my right pinky on the bottom to lend support, while placing a sideways position forefinger on top in order to hold the lid in place. With my hand positioned just so, like a stiffened claw, I began to pour. But there was a problem. The lid was on at the wrong angle, and the leaves began to fall out. I lost the moment. Hot water came pouring down the sides, and I dropped the bowl into the tea tray. Amin made no comment, and I took his silence to mean that he had expected the result. He went through the process of pouring several times more until we had about 6 tiny cupfuls each. Making tea from leaves is so common across China that some historians actually believe Marco Polo never made it to China because he failed to mention the curious practice of drinking tea. In his account, Polo went to great lengths to discuss the popularity of wine across the country, but he forgot this other, far more common beverage, which had not yet been introduced in Europe. There were other problems with Marco Polo's account. He took the time to mention that the Chinese people ate rice, but he failed to mention how they ate it, with chopsticks. He described the allure of Chinese women, but made no mention of foot binding. He claimed to have arrived at China from the north, and yet he never noticed the Great Wall. Marco Polo claimed not only that he was a traveler to the Far East, but also that he had served the Great Khan. According to his account, he was made mayor of Yangzhou, then a pleasure city that was to Imperial China what Las Vegas is to the United States. But while official Chinese documents record other Italians who visited China during this period, there was never any mention of Marco Polo. And he never used any Chinese place names either. Instead, he used names from Arabic and Persian. 17 years was a bit longer than I had lived in China, and it was certainly as long as many other expatriates I knew who were similarly rooted in the country. Even those who went out of their way not to learn Mandarin still managed to pick up a great deal of it during their tenure. How could it be that Marco Polo never managed to pick up even a little bit of the language? Then again, he never bothered to mention the unusual-looking Chinese characters that he would have seen everywhere. Marco Polo was an exaggerator, a teller of tall tales. He had claimed that one Chinese city had as many as 12,000 bridges, where another observer traveling through at roughly the same time claimed only 360 such structures. He said that the Chinese enjoyed eating pears that weighed 10 pounds each, and that the citizens of Hangzhou lived in buildings that were 8 to 10 stories high, when they surely lived in buildings that were not even half that height. Whether Marco Polo actually made it to China is beside the point, really. His impact on history was to inspire generations of Western explorers. Christopher Columbus was said to have carried Polo's account with him on his journey to find a passage to the Orient, and the result of such an inspired expedition gave us both North and South America. The notion of the Far East as an exotic place needed no exaggeration, and perhaps the real problem with Marco Polo's account was not its magnification, but that it missed the mark. It was not, as so many have claimed, China's scale that was fascinating, but certain cultural elements, and I was most interested in those that had an impact on business. Despite our difficulties with quality at King Chemical, Bernie had success in signing up new, larger customers, and volume kept growing. ShopCorp was Johnson Carter's largest and most conservative customer to date, and no decision could be made on any order until a large committee had convened. When this one customer sent email messages, there were no fewer than a dozen people copied, and their specification sheets were highly detailed and required the signature of Bernie himself. Nothing could be changed without prior written approval, not even the smallest change to label artwork. Sister knew this, but decided to make changes to the label design anyway. Without notifying anyone else, King Chemical shrank the size of the labels so that they were easier to apply to bottles. It was not a big difference, but it was a deviation from the dimensions that ShopCorp had made clear on their specifications sheets. Once discovered, we had to inform ShopCorp of the change, however small. I told Sister that I had to notify the company. "Don't tell them. They won't notice," she said. "You almost didn't notice." In China, there was no penalty for getting caught in any production scheme. The usual consequence was being forced to make the product properly the next time around. At the very worst, the manufacturer might be asked to redo an order. In the United States, things worked a little differently. If our customer learned that we defied them in any way that seemed willful, it would have perceived it as a breach of trust. Johnson Carter could claim that it was innocent, but retailers cared little for the difficulties we faced in China. Bernie won business by explaining that we were the trouble-free solution, and to win business, he suggested that we were involved in a joint venture with King Chemical. This had been done in order to raise the level of confidence in the operation, and so there was no way that we could tell retailers, "The factory did it to us again. Sorry." The factory was never forthcoming about unilateral changes it made, and yet, oddly enough, they would answer specific questions. If asked whether the product had been changed generally, they would not answer in the affirmative. If asked specifically, however, whether a change had been made to label sizes, they would then admit it. It was only after I guessed that the labels had been made smaller and asked that Sister told me yes, they had. The problem with this system was that we had to know what questions to ask in order to get at any sort of meaningful response. American consumers were accustomed to receiving exactly what they had ordered. Chinese manufacturers had a slightly different philosophy when it came to customer relationships. They believed that the customer's exact wishes mattered only as far as they were necessary to capture the initial order. Beyond that, they figured, what an importer didn't know couldn't hurt it. My main contact at ShopCorp, Janet, was adamant that the product matched both the specifications sheet and the product sample set. Those who were in charge of buying at the big retailers had generously sized egos. While earning modest salaries, they understood how decisions they made directly affected an importer's economic future. If a buyer suspected that we took her for a fool, she would end the business relationship and choose another vendor. Johnson Carter walked on eggshells, worrying how to please its customers, but King Chemical did not take the same approach with its own customers. Quite the contrary, we were eventually reduced to begging in order to have our products made properly. We had to plead in order to get the factory not to make unilateral specification changes. King Chemical felt a genuine right to make product modifications without informing us, and the scope and freedom they accorded themselves increased over time. And the tone of the relationship changed as well. Around the time we picked up the account for ShopCorp, whenever we sent new orders to the factory, the response was that the factory would consider our request. Chinese factories were turning the notion of customer service on its head. Confucian ideology saw all human relationships as fitting within a natural hierarchy. Just as a father held a place above the son, the emperor was superior to his subjects. In China, the individuals involved in a relationship were not meant to be on equal footing, and in the manufacturing sector, there was a growing sense that in the natural order, the factory was above and its customer somewhere below. In ancient times, foreign emissaries traveled to China in order to pay tribute to the emperor. In return for their submission, the emperor left a visitor with gifts to carry home. King Chemical increasingly looked on Johnson Carter in a similar way. The money that the importer paid was like tribute offered, and gifts that we received in return came in the form of liquid soap and body wash. The factory understood the notion of pleasing customers when they were just starting out, or when they were struggling along. But this was just feigned modesty, part of the stagecraft, a means of catching business. Once the manufacturer achieved a degree of success, it saw itself in the imperial role, while relegating the importer to that of a mere supplicant. Sister and I stood in the warehouse. On one side of the long building were some of the company's counterfeit products, fake brands that they made and sold into the domestic market. One product of theirs was called Olan, and had a logo that mimicked the famous Olay brand. Another product in the warehouse, Resoft, looked just like a Procter & Gamble product named Rejoice, which sold very well in South China. The factory even had its own knockoff version of P&G's best-selling Zest body wash. The packaging was identical, except that the factory's version was called Best. It seemed at this point that the two companies had come to an understanding, and I took the opportunity to confirm that we had put some of the quality games behind us. I asked Sister if she could promise that we would not have more surprises with quality. "Why don't you trust us?" she asked, sounding disappointed and hurt. I was inclined to give her a few reasons, but she changed the subject, asking me whether it gets cold in Chicago. ShopCorp had a receiving warehouse not far from that city, and I thought it was a strange question. "Yes," I said. "It does get cold in Chicago." "Do they have snow?" Sister asked. "In the winter, sure, they get snow." Chinese in the South sometimes asked about snow because they never saw any of it, but this did not seem to be about a general curiosity over weather. What could these questions about snow in Chicago really be about? ShopCorp was based near Chicago. Could it be that Sister was planning some kind of trip to the United States? The mention of snow, I would understand later, was a hint, a small clue, a suggestion of where I should have been paying careful attention, and perhaps where I might have asked some specific questions. Winter had come, not just to Chicago, but also to South China. One evening at home, I went to a windowsill where I had placed a number of Johnson Carter products. I picked up a bottle of shampoo and noticed that the formulation seemed frozen. The temperature outside was cold, but it was nowhere near freezing. I shook the bottle, and the shampoo came loose from the edges and bounced around a bit. It had an odd consistency, I noticed. It seemed that the cold weather had turned the formulation into jelly. "What do you mean, jelly?" Bernie asked. I told him that the formulation was acting strangely and that it had to do with cold weather. Typically, Bernie jumped all over any bad news, but this information was too much. Instead of processing it, he blocked out what I was trying to explain. I tried again to tell him that the cold weather was making the shampoo viscous, that it had turned hard. I told him to think jello. "I don't know what that means," he shouted. To make it clear, I sent him a video file that showed one of our bottles of shampoo tipped on its side. The formulation would not pour, but had to be pushed out with force. It came out in clumps, plop, 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 looking nothing like shampoo. The sample had come from the shipment that had already gone to ShopCorp. There was panic in New York, and Bernie demanded to know what was going on. The factory would not provide any details on the formulation, presumably because they were afraid that we would discover something even more unsettling. Bernie asked not only for a confirmation of his ingredients list, but also for a more detailed breakdown. He had these from a previous supplier, but King Chemical would not supply the data. Desperate to learn more about the formulations, Bernie asked me to speak with anyone who might help. I met another manufacturer at a trade show months earlier. We spoke only briefly about the possibility of making them an alternate supplier, but when the prices quoted by the factory were too high, discussions had ended. Finding a competing manufacturer who would provide meaningful details was one way of getting around a supplier that withheld information. Factories were tight-lipped, except when they were dangling trade secrets as an enticement. Those who could not compete on price were especially forthcoming with such inside information. In China, where so many hid the truth, candor itself was a valuable commodity. The factory man agreed to meet me at my home, where I handed him a bottle of our shampoo, one that was golden yellow in color. He placed a small amount of the formulation on the palm of his hand and tapped at it with his forefinger. He showed me how his finger bounced on the surface and would not stick to the shampoo. It was, he explained, the sign of an inferior product. It was much worse than shampoos sold in China, he said. You couldn't sell this here, that's for sure.
You couldn't?
Of course not. China has standards. This kind of shampoo would be for export only. He was surprised that we were exporting this kind of product to the United States. I would have guessed that this would be for some market, like Bolivia, he said. It didn't sound encouraging. He then looked at the date stamped on the bottom of the bottle. We were using an expiration date that was 5 years out. China limited shelf life on product like this to only 3 years. Bernie did not like what I told him. What did he mean by Bolivia? He asked. He also thought that was a strange comment. It was imperative, he said, that we get the ingredients lists from the factory. As a customer, we were entitled to them, but the factory would not release the information. I had tried with persistent requests, but the factory suggested that we already had the ingredients lists. They were on the back label of each of our products, and that was enough. Sister said that she was not compelled to provide a breakdown. The details were their trade secrets, she insisted. This infuriated Bernie. The product line came from my sample set. What trade secrets? It's my fucking product. The factory insisted that it had copied Johnson Carter's original product line exactly, but the method by which they had done so was proprietary. In other words, the formulations were Johnson Carter's all right, but they could not tell us what ingredients were in them. It could only happen in China. The factory was claiming intellectual property rights over its copying methods. Of all the Chinese artifacts that I have read about or seen, my favorite is a jade piece that belongs to the National Palace Museum in Taipei, where the greatest treasures of Chinese emperors are housed. As with many classic pieces, what fascinates is less the piece itself than the story that goes with it. Emperor Qianlong, who ruled for most of the 18th century during the Qing Dynasty, had been admiring his collection one day when he noticed a particular item. It was a small jade cup said to have been made during the Ming Dynasty, which lasted from the 14th to the 17th centuries. While he liked the piece, there was something about it that caused him to doubt its provenance. He called for one of his top artists to take a look and issue his professional opinion. The artist, who also served as the emperor's curator, looked at the cup and declared that he had good news and bad news. The bad news was that, while the cup had been done in the Ming style, it was actually a fake. The good news was that he could identify the artifact's creator. It was, said the curator, the work of his own grandfather. The curator's grandfather had been a masterful copier. He knew not just how to make the jade cup in the Ming style, but he also understood how to make it appear genuinely old as well. Learning that the piece was a fake did not upset the emperor at all. Quite the opposite, he was impressed, and he praised the piece. He also complimented its creator for having done such a skillful job. So many others created copies, the emperor noted, but few were as good at his job. The emperor complained that the others rushed the job and could therefore not be called artists. It is hard to imagine the head of any state looking at an imitation and lavishing such unbounded praise, but that is what Qianlong had done. The emperor even had a special box commissioned for the jade cup, which he saw as a model of sorts, and in the box he had inscribed a kind of treatise on the art of counterfeiting. American business leaders and politicians who have pushed for increased intellectual property protection in China over the years have failed to acknowledge the cultural origins of counterfeiting. It is not just that counterfeit products are tolerated in the country, they are revered. Chinese art collections are filled with fakes, and catalogs published by the world's leading auction houses, Christie's, Sotheby's, and Bonhams, all contain a prominent disclaimer to the effect that forgeries are so prevalent and of such high quality that no firm statement can be made about the authenticity of any of the pieces that they offer. China's counterfeit culture runs deep, and evidence of this can be found in the great volume of counterfeit currency floating around South China as well. In all manner of forgeries, there is a high-end market, a low-end market, and many grades in between, but these currency notes floating about were every bit like the real thing. One morning, getting out of a taxi, I unwittingly handed the driver a counterfeit 50 renminbi note that had been fobbed off on me at some earlier point. The driver reached out to take the bill, touched it, for only the briefest moment, and with his arm still outstretched, signaled for me to take it back. He had not even looked at it, but he could tell that it was a fake. Counterfeiting was so common in China that average people had to learn how to identify a copy. At the factory, this ability was even more critical. Even those industrialists who did not engage in counterfeiting themselves had to know how to spot fakes that might be passed their way by competitors or suppliers. If a manufacturer did not know how to catch a fake, then it was likely to receive raw materials that were inferior. Competition in China was intense, and manufacturers that were the most skillful at screening out fakes were the ones most likely to survive. The ability to counterfeit products was correlated to speed in any case. One importer complained to me about how he sent a prototype to a supplier in China, and before the manufactured goods arrived by ship, a salesman had shown up at his office with samples sent by courier express. He figured that it was not his own factory in this case, but a competitor who had gotten hold of the sample and duplicated it in record time. The speed with which China manufacturing moved was a double-edged sword. Importers could count on a manufacturer to take an initial sample and put it into production with extreme speed, but then the counterfeiters moved just as quickly and with great skill. Counterfeiting, as it was most commonly understood, involved the placement of a brand name on a product by a manufacturer that was not authorized to produce goods for that company. Another form involved the manufacture of a brand name product by a legitimate producer who then moonlighted to produce excess goods in a so-called third shift operation. In some of these cases, the manufacturer produced an inferior version of the product so that the owner of the brand not only suffered sales loss, but also ran the risk of brand erosion in the marketplace. In the worst cases, the most insidious, and perhaps the most prevalent form of counterfeiting, factories took an original product from a customer and then reinvented the product so that it looked every bit like the real thing, but was in fact a ripoff. Johnson Carter was like the emperor who could not determine if he owned the real thing or an imitation, except that in our case, we had no curator on staff and we were considerably less thrilled by the display of talent involved in the counterfeiting of our product. The factory's chemist was a friendly sort, with the thoughtful demeanor of a scientist. He was soft-spoken and introverted, and he wore thick glasses that sat slightly crooked on his square face. I took a chance and asked him directly if he knew what was wrong with the formulation. Looking slightly embarrassed, he said that he did, and he tipped me off about a certain chemical ingredient that was in short supply in our formulations. In China, there was a tendency to refer to many chemicals by a numeric shorthand. He indicated the ingredient to me using a 3-digit number, and he suggested that we would do all right if we argued to have more of that one ingredient added. As vague as he was, it was more information than Sister provided, and I took his discretion as concern for his job. Factory workers traded in rumor, and it was rarely the case that only one person in any plant was privy to certain tricks. One of the things that Americans lost in taking production overseas was the ability for average workers to report consumer product safety issues. For most workers in China, the U.S. consumer was an abstraction, and even if someone at a factory was willing to make a report, where would that worker go? There was no place to leave an anonymous tip, and the media was controlled by China's central government. In 2007, when a number of toy suppliers were found to have used toxic lead paint, there must have been hundreds of workers who knew it was happening. In addition to the boss who had green-lighted the paint, there would have been a purchasing manager, as well as a receiving clerk. And then there were the employees on the shop floor. Lead paint was preferred in part because it dried faster. It was possible that someone noticed, or at least had heard about the substitution. While factories were good at keeping secrets from foreign buyers, inside their own houses, gossip was rampant. It was used as entertainment and for survival. In China, whistleblowers were not seen as heroes, but as social disruptors. More often than not, the whistleblower was thought to be seeking personal gain at the expense of the collective. Confucianism holds that authority must be respected, and so by definition, a manufacturer gets the benefit of the doubt. Export manufacturing was a national interest, arguably the single most important interest of the ruling Communist Party. Even if a factory is actually doing something wrong, the whistleblower automatically becomes an enemy of the state. For importers who fought for higher quality levels and clear standards, the most insulting part about input substitutions and forgeries was that the factories ended up blaming their victims. When King Chemical was caught at delivering an inferior product, their retort was like salt in a wound. "For the price you were paying," Sister said, "what did you expect?" Was it a legitimate defense? After having agreed to make a product at a given price, the factory responsible for manufacturing manipulated quality so that in the end, the customer received something inferior to what it had bargained for. Apologists for China manufacturing have suggested that these factories had no choice, margins were tight, and they were not earning as much as they used to. Arguments along these lines were specious, and Americans who allowed them for manufacturers in China would never have tolerated similarly unethical behavior from a manufacturer in their own country. In the United States, when an armed robber was caught and pled his case, the last thing a judge wanted to hear was how the accused was hard up. Poverty was no excuse. And anyway, how could hard times be used as an excuse when China was growing so rapidly? China was hardly as poor as it was 30 years ago, or even 10 years ago. That was doubly true of the southern region that housed so many export manufacturers. China was experiencing the greatest economic expansion in world history, and much of this was led by the export manufacturing sector, which itself was growing much faster than the overall Chinese economy. If there was a relationship between wealth and ethics, it was more than likely a negative correlation. When China's export manufacturing miracle was just taking off, there were fewer quality problems, not more. Desperate manufacturers did not dare risk upsetting important new customers who were not yet beholden to them and could easily take their business elsewhere. It was only once these manufacturers achieved a degree of success and had put some money in the bank that they actually took these wild chances with manipulating quality. The increased occurrence of quality fade had much to do with increases in skill level and tricks of the trade. After all, it took a certain degree of ability to create a product that looked like the real thing, but that was in fact a version that was cheaper to produce. And that skill was perfected the more it was practiced. Because many manufacturers that engaged in quality fade had already achieved some degree of success, hard times alone could not be the only explanation. The impression that I got at some of the factories that engaged in quality manipulation schemes is that they did so after growing bored with their more conventional successes. There was a great deal of excitement that came with getting a new business off the ground. These manufacturers were thrilled when they signed up their first major customer, and they got another kick from orders that were especially large. When deal flow leveled out, factory owners looked for other ways in which they could capture that hint of thrill. The poverty myth was dispelled at least to some extent by one rather public example. Mattel's supplier in the lead paint case was run by an industrialist said to be worth $1.1 billion. The manufacturer, coincidentally, had a 15-year relationship with the toy giant, which countered another argument made, that these supplier relationships necessarily improved over time and with greater familiarity. China manufacturing was a game played on a field without referees. There was no government agency in China where an importer could go to lodge a complaint, and there were only limited opportunities for recourse through the legal system there. In the abstract, manufacturers did not want to kill the goose that was laying their golden eggs, and so in practice, they focused on tactics where they might score a few quick hits. Their aim was to optimize profitability over the short term without losing the long-term customer. Striking the right balance was key. Sister was now aware that they had gone too far in manipulating Johnson Carter's product line. She still would not explain how the product had turned into gelatin, but she said that she would make it better. The only thing that Bernie had to do, of course, was agree to an across-the-board price increase on the Johnson Carter product line. Sister kept us in the dark about as much as she could, and we only learned bit by bit how the factory was able to manipulate quality. No matter how long we were at it, it seemed that there was always some new and unpredictable trick. This fear of the unknown was actually what made so many importers nervous. They could not imagine what they didn't know. We had too many unknown unknowns. While importers claimed that they wanted to learn precisely how their products out of China were being made, at the same time, they were afraid to dig too deep. Pressing for details might mean uncovering a problem that could not be ignored. It meant fixing things, and pressuring a supplier to improve quality put upward pressure on pricing. Chinese manufacturers were good at keeping costs low. It was their true competitive advantage, but importers saw an advantage in not knowing all of their suppliers' little secrets. Around the time that we learned that our shampoo was turning into jelly, Johnson Carter asked King Chemical if it was capable of making an underarm deodorant. Chinese were not big on deodorant, and what was available in the local market was usually the roll-on kind anyway. What we needed for the U.S. market was a dry stick version. To save time, I gave the factory a stick of deodorant that I had purchased in the United States. Sister looked at it and said that, while it might take time, she was convinced that she could get it duplicated. It was a bold declaration, given that no other manufacturer in China's health and beauty care sector had managed to pull it off yet. The prototype came in, and it looked promising. The factory had created a number of molds, 5 in all, and had replicated the look and feel of the casing down to the trademark baby blue color of the original. There was even a knob on the bottom, which was turned to push the deodorant upwards. I turned the knob and was surprised to find that the mechanism actually worked. The plastic part was not easy to make, and it required a bit of investment and time on the factory's part. While the casing was impressive, I touched the product itself and got a surprise. The deodorant stick was not at all dry. I pressed my fingertip against the white substance and found that my finger went right into it, as if into a stick of warm butter. The deodorant was not going to be easy to make. The factory knew this, but rather than working on the chemical part first, they went ahead and spent probably thousands of dollars to create the casing. It was entirely backwards, but this was how manufacturers in China built their products from the outside in. First, they made a product that looked like something that could be sold, and then they focused on the actual functioning mechanism. Outward appearances got the initial focus, and then came the product's intrinsic features. It was a production philosophy that matched the national concern for face, and in the end, it was reminiscent of Qianlong Emperor's respect for the semblance of an art object, regardless of authenticity. It also made good business sense. It was exorbitant to put a product into production before receiving an actual order, and the manufacturer had to convince the prospective importer that it could make the product in question. Creating the outward appearance of the thing was often just enough to get the order initiated. Once funds were transferred to China, the manufacturer could then work on the part about getting the product right. This particular practice also contributed to quality fade. After the factory had won the initial order, and after it expended a great deal of effort figuring out how to get the product made properly, there was often not much left to do. The factory took its surplus time and sank it back into the product, tinkering with it to see where savings could be realized. The manufacturer looked for ways to make the product appear to be the same on the outside, while on the inside it might be a different story.